From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is the podcast version of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with veteran literary agent Jeff Herman. His 28th edition of the Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents came out in the fall from New World Library. Jeff Herman opened his literary agency in the mid-80s, while in his mid-20s, he has made nearly 1,000 book deals, including many bestsellers. His own books include Jeff Herman's Guide to Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents, and Write the Perfect Book Proposal, which is co-authored with Deborah Herman. He has presented hundreds of workshops about writing and publishing. Shortly after graduating from Syracuse University, Jeff Herman was riding the subway on a hot summer day when he spotted an ad stating, "I found my job," in the New York Times. He promptly bought a copy of the Times and answered some help wanted ads. A few days later, he was summoned for an interview with the publicity director at an independent publishing house and was hired on the spot as her assistant for $200 a week. This was 1981. Showering, shaving, wearing a suit, saying little, and promising to show up were the clinchers. The publicity department comprised Herman and his boss, who took her summer vacation his first week on the job. He was left in charge, though he knew nothing about publicity, publishing, or how an office functioned. But he was a quick study and soon helped make When Bad Things Happen to Good People a massive bestseller. In time, he moved into corporate marketing, where he worked on various product promotion campaigns for Nabisco, AT&T, and many other large and small brands, but books were his passion and calling. Today, Jeff Herman is a veteran literary agent, entrepreneur, and author. His areas of editorial expertise include popular, business, spirituality, and most other areas of nonfiction. He says, "If I feel I can sell it, I'll represent it." When I spoke with Jeff Herman last week, I asked him what he would say to a writer who is new to the objective of publication. How might he describe the task at hand? I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, on one hand, be optimistic and go with the attitude that you will be published.
Yeah.
Don't ever take the attitude that, oh, it's impossible. Okay. Just really maintain that attitude because a few people actually get published right away, but they're the minority.
Right.
And for some people, you know, it takes a long time. It's a process. And the first step you should really do, though, is understand not just the marketplace in the sense of what's going on in the bookstore. That's the consumer end of it. What you really need to do is try to get some insights into the production end of it. And when I say production, I don't mean what's going on in the printing presses. I mean what's going on in the human offices
okay.
of book publishers and literary agents, and how they are figuring out to make decisions and not make decisions sometimes about publishing. And I mean, that's a whole universe which can't be learned in a minute, but it can be learned through time and through research and through networking and through trial and error and by reading some good books about the subject.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, your guide, which has come out through the years, and I believe this, it's appropriate to say this is an updated version of a guide that's been in existence
Correct.
For a long time. So what's new about this version of the guide?
Well, it tries to, and, you know, we succeed, I think, to a great extent. It tries to stay current with the trends of what's happening and also with who the actual human beings are that are making these decisions, because it's actually a very subjective industry, and people come and go. So what we try to do with the book is keep on top of what publishers are publishing, because that changes who the publishers are, where they are, whether they still exist. And then we try to give as much information as we can about who the actual acquisition editors are, by name, title, contact information, and what they are looking for. because each of them is looking for their own lists, and they're not just generalists for the most part.
Right.
Every publisher and every editor has areas of focus. So we try to keep track with that. And then, of course, there's the agents. And the agents do not change as rapidly as the publishing personnel does, because the agents tend to be self-employed, and self-employed people might retire, but they don't fire themselves as much, or they don't jump to another job as much, because these are mostly entrepreneurial mom-and-pop-based businesses, the agencies. So we do try to reflect who the agents are, the agencies, and we try to get each of the agents to a certain extent to talk to the reader by asking a range of questions, which on the face of it might appear to be off topic. The idea behind that is to get them to inadvertently show a little bit about their personality and their inclinations, because it is such a subjective industry.
Yeah, my favorite was, do you think Earth was created a few thousand years ago or several billion years ago? And it's funny because some of the agents were like, this is off topic, I'm not answering this. But I thought, that's such a great way to let you know what their sort of philosophy is in the world.
And even that answer tells you something.
It does.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that stood out. So who is in your guide and who is not? Your guide has a certain number of people. It seems probably like it's much more comprehensive for the publishing side, but the agent side, I know that on, I think it's Query Tracker, they list something like 1,700 agents. So who got into this?
Okay. We have approximately 250 agents. And none of the, I don't put agents in who don't want to be in the book. So there are a few dozen perfectly bona fide, qualified, highly successful agents who, for whatever reason, that maybe they just didn't get back to me because they're too busy, the same as they don't always get back to their clients because they're too busy.
Right.
Or, you know, they may not really be hungry for new clients because they are servicing the clients they already have and are happy with the referrals that they get through that. So not every agent who is a qualified agent is in the book. However, some of these listings go way into the outfield and into the weeds because there are many firms and individuals that say we are a literary agency.
Yeah.
And it's usually legal to say that, but that doesn't mean they really are. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that they've actually ever agented a book.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they even try to actually agent the book. A lot of them are what I call honeypots, meaning that they will assume that a lot of the writers don't really know the business very well. And they will attract these people with, and these are intelligent people. They're just hungry. They will, I mean, the people that, the writers.
Yes.
And they will attract these people, you know, promising them exactly what they want, which is to get published.
Right.
But then it turns out that it's really an opportunity to funnel these individuals into a menu of pay-for services, which may or may not have any real quality to them. So that's my biggest concern as you get further and further away and you get into these huge databases. Because there's really only a few hundred, less than 500 for sure, of active, legitimate literary agents. And a real literary agent only works on a commission.
Mm-hmm.
They won't charge you anything.
Mm-hmm.
They won't charge to read your book. They won't charge to sell the book. It's all commission-based, meaning
right.
that they have to get you a deal.
Right. Which is that's quite extraordinary if you think about it. I mean, that model is unusual in the business world, I would think, at this point in time.
Well, there are exceptions, in fairness. You see, what happened was as the industry consolidated and the pool of revenues consolidated, a lot of independent agents found that they were not making as many commissions. So they set up side businesses. Mm-hmm. where a person, not reading fees, but side businesses, where a writer can retain the agent or someone on the agent's staff, maybe to help them make their manuscript that much better.
Mm-hmm.
And those services are fine.
Yeah.
You know, as long as there's a clear boundary between what's the agency and what's these other services, and as long as it's clear that using the agency services isn't contingent upon you purchasing these other services.
Right. Okay.
But I wanted to put that out there because I've seen that happening.
All right. Now you write in the book about being a gift and not being a nag. This is to potential clients, people who are trying to get an agent.
Yes.
But you also write about trying to stand out. So how does one stand out without being coy or annoying or, you know, just sort of ruining their own chances?
Yeah. Well, you know, nobody in any business wants somebody who's going to cost more than they give you in return. So nagging is part of the cost of business. If you're working with an agent and you're a nag, that's part of the cost of business that the agent has to absorb. They would prefer that they didn't have to.
Right.
Now, the reason they will absorb it is because you're overcompensating for the fact that you're a nag or whatever, the fact that you're generating revenue through your work product.
Right.
So, you get to be that nag. But the point is that before you're a client and all you're doing is you're presenting yourself as being a nag before you present yourself as being a cash cow, you will be overlooked.
Right.
And I think we all know what a nag is or how a nag presents it. And it could be that the person is just over-eager or over-anxious, you know, and that's okay. You know, I mean, we're all human. But there is something about being pestered, or the term of art is a high-maintenance person.
Right.
And that's always going to be a deficit. It doesn't mean you won't get an agent. It doesn't mean you won't get a publisher. But the fact that you're high-maintenance is going to detract from the benefits that you're providing to other people.
Okay.
So there are ways to be assertive, which are very appropriate, and do not give you bad marks.
Yeah.
I think it's fine to say, you know, okay, I'm sending you this manuscript upon your request on this date, say 30 days later. On this date, I'm going to follow up with an email and a phone call to see if you've had an opportunity to read it yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's perfectly appropriate. It doesn't mean that what's annoying is after the agent requests your manuscript, you email it in, and then 3 days later, you're calling to find out what he or she thinks of it.
Right, right, right.
See, that's pressure.
Yes. What if you are already working with an agent, they've signed you, you send them your manuscript, and then you don't hear for a very long time? You know, what's appropriate as far as contact or do you just figure out who each person is and how to move forward together?
That's a good question. That's an excellent question. And the first thing I'll say is that agents, like most people, like all people, are very far from perfect.
Yeah.
But you, as a writer who is represented by that agency, you have certain rights. And you're entitled to have certain reasonable expectations. And one of the most basic is, what's happening? You're entitled to know what's happening. Now, the best way to preempt confusion and puzzlement and dissension going forward is at the very outset to establish a guideline as to when you're going to hear something and from the agent, you know, when you might hear something. It's good for the writer to be proactive if they're going to work with an agent and say, ask some very basic questions. How long do you think it might take to sell my work,
mm-hmm.
or to know that you're not going to sell it? Do you go one publisher at a time, or are you intending to go several publishers at a time, a multiple submission, mm-hmm. which of course speeds up the process one way or the other. Mm-hmm. You're entitled to know how often you might hear directly from the agent, or how often it would be acceptable for you to check in to get information.
Right.
And just say, you know, I don't want to make myself a unreasonable burden. You don't have to actually say that, but that's the given. But in business, this is a transaction between you and the agent, and you don't have to be, once you're a client, you don't have to become a peasant.
Right.
In this relationship, because if you allow yourself to become a peasant, you'll be viewed as a peasant.
Right.
Because
right.
that's what you said I am. So, don't be obnoxious. Don't call up screaming, you know. I mean, people sometimes revert to family of origin situations, and it's kind of like the agent becomes the personification of the negligent parent or, you know, the bully or whatever. So, you know, put all your baggage away and be very objective. This is business.
Right. You have one aspect of the book is interviews with the agents that you include in the guide. And one of the questions is, what's the client from hell? And I remember I'm not remembering who the agent was, but one of them talked about a client who calls screaming and acts just like a toddler. And that's the client from hell. So that was interesting.
When agents get together, what do we talk about? You know, there's always going to be one of us will be the braggart who will either be fabricating or maybe he or she is being truthful about the billion-dollar deals they've made just within the last 10 minutes, you know.
And right.
Everyone spaces, all the other agents space that person out because he or she is annoying. But when we really just want to be human beings with each other, what do? We gossip. Mm-hmm. And what are we going to gossip about? We'll gossip about editors we know in common. And then we'll gossip about clients. We don't know the clients in common, but we know the archetypes.
Right.
And so we'll gossip about those crazy archetypes, which are really a very tiny fraction of any agent's client base, unless they're a masochist. but they're the ones that create the stories that we could then share with each other.
Now, we can all sort of imagine what the client from hell might look like in different iterations, but what to you is the best client? Like, how does someone conduct him or herself to be the best client for you?
Well, I like people who keep it simple, you know, who don't zigzag in what their expectations are, in what they're requesting. I think people need to be very consistent and honest about things, especially when it comes time to accepting or negotiating terms from a publisher. If an author accepts a certain condition on a Monday, it's best if they don't on a Tuesday change their mind or bring in new conditions. There needs to be in any business, there needs to be a consistency and mutual respect.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I see that, that there's a mutual respect and a preference for clarity and honesty, I think that really is a very healthy basis for a relationship.
Okay, great. Now, you write about a couple of different situations that I found really interesting. One is, you know, the sort of cliche of the slush pile, and you say, this is sort of now a slush cloud. And I thought that was great because, of course, everything's digital now. So it's even less likely that someone's going to stumble across your manuscript and look at it. But what is the outcome of that for people, like the slush pile becoming a slush cloud?
Okay, well, it's easier for the editors and the agents because we don't have to clutter our offices with paper.
That must be really nice.
And it actually makes it much easier to find something. I mean, someone may call me and say, you know, I emailed you this on this day. Now, if they say I mailed it to you on this day and we're still in the paper world, it's going to be really difficult for me to go through a pile and find it.
Right.
But because they gave me the date that it was emailed, you know, I can just go into my box and look at the submissions from that day. So, I mean, it just has so many advantages. I don't think it necessarily hurts or helps whether or not you're actually going to get read faster or more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just the technology is objective. It has logistical advantages for both parties. The writer doesn't have to go make 10 photocopies of a manuscript for 5 to 10 cents a page.
Right.
Doesn't have to go to FedEx or the post office and ship it for $10 or $15 or whatever it is if they send it overnight. You know, I mean, the process of trying to get published before digitization of the process would cost a writer hundreds of dollars a year easily.
Yeah.
And for some writers, you know, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
For some people. So it has... It has made a difference. Does it mean you will get seen faster? I don't think so.
Okay. Now, you also write about ignored writer syndrome. You want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, the ignored writer, in my opinion, is the one who's already been published. And, well, there's two different kinds. There's the writer who wants to get published and nobody seems to care.
Right.
I mean, they can't even get a rejection letter.
And that's very common.
And there's nothing personal about that.
Right.
It's simply because the business is too cluttered. And not everyone has the time or a structure for responding negatively or responding at all or even necessarily catching it. What you sent in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other ignored writer is the one who's already been published. And now all of a sudden, everybody, including the agent perhaps, is on to the next client, the next author.
Right.
Then whatever is in there. It's a train. You know, you have your turn in the station as a writer, and everyone is looking at you and working on you and helping edit you and designing your cover and working out some press releases and everything that goes with it. And that feels exciting. And then all of a sudden, another train car pulls in. And that's the one that's getting the attention.
Yeah.
And that can be very disheartening for a writer because they're yesterday's train.
Does that usually go along with sales, though? I mean, if a writer's
now,
book is selling, they're not going to be ignored, correct?
Okay. If yes, there's always a hierarchy. If you are a writer who is helping to literally pay the overhead of that publishing company through the sales of your book, you're never yesterday's train, and you have a different track. There's a different track for you
mm-hmm.
because you're making money mm-hmm. for everybody else. But if the book didn't do that well,
yeah.
And it's not doing that well, or it's just doing okay, you don't get to go over to that other track.
Right.
You're going to linger on this other track, and your book will, you know, your book may stay in print for a very long time and even generate consistent royalties, but it's not at the level of revenue generation where people are going to really find a lot of time for you.
Yeah. One of the biggest tasks for the writer who's trying to get published is to write a query letter. There's a format for this, an appropriate format. I'm just wondering if you can talk about a few moments that have stood out for you recently in query letters that you received, either for good or for not good.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why the query letter, which is really a pitch letter, is so essential is because you have to understand, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are trying to get published, maybe millions in a given year are trying to get published.
Right.
And no agency or publishing company has the infrastructure, the bandwidth to, in any qualitative way, look at all that content that's being generated.
Right.
Okay, there's just no way. So the query letter becomes the first pass. The first thing you do is, gee, is it a romance novel? Is it a woman's mystery? Is it a nonfiction book about sales? I mean, that's the first thing you want to know. because you may be an agent who only does romance novels. So if you're getting a pitch letter that says, I want you to read my narrative about world history or whatever, it doesn't matter who you are or what you are. The agent's going to stop reading and know that they don't have to invest any more time in you.
Right.
Because they have nothing to offer you. They're only doing romance novels. That's where the pre-research comes in, you know, so that you should target agents who actually represent what you're writing. So that's the first thing that a query letter has to do, is create clarity as to category.
Yeah.
The next thing you want to do is hold attention, okay? Because the typical agent or editor is rejecting about 99% of what they see. We're not all across, you know, we're not rejecting the same 99%. That's the good thing.
Yeah.
We're all rejecting a different 99%.
Okay.
And we're all accepting a different 1%. But they are going to approach each query letter they get, assuming that it's in the 99%, because that's the odds. That's the statistics. Okay?
Yeah.
So you need to break through that immediate prejudice against the letter by engaging the mind, the brain, the gut of the person who's reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Same like they do with Madison Avenue advertising. Okay?
Right.
How do you sell laundry detergent? You create a relationship with the viewer. So you need to create a relationship with the person reading your book right away. And there are ways to do that. First thing I do is I tell people, flatter who you're writing to. Know who you're writing to by doing some research about them. And tell them how much you respect the books that they've edited or agented. Name one of them. You know, and what an honor it is to be able to reach out to you in this way. Don't be so patronizing that the person realizes that they're being patronized.
Sure.
Do it in a way so that the person on some level probably knows they're being patronized, but is enjoying it anyway because you're affirming for them who they are.
Right.
You know,
sure.
Same as you want to be affirmed. Agents and editors want to be affirmed. Guess what? They're human beings.
Yeah.
So that's one step, okay? You don't have to do that. Another one is to open your paragraph saying something exciting or relevant about the project. It could be, if it's fiction, it could be some actual dialogue, you know, or something, you know, or a plot point, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But keep the paragraph short. Dense paragraphs are really hard to read, especially on a screen. Your letter doesn't need to be more than a page. So make sure that there's clarity about what the project is, that there's something that will engage the reader's, meaning in this case, the agent or the editor's brain, mind, and gut, give more enticements about the project, and give more clarification, and make a statement about how much is available, complete manuscript, chapters, proposal. Oh, and of course, say something about yourself, especially as it might relate to the project. If it's nonfiction, your credentials or experiences, or your platform is what it's called, might be very crucial.
Right.
So you give that. If it's fiction and you've won awards or you've attended workshops or whatever it is, say something that makes you look serious. Don't say that I won a Pulitzer Prize unless you really did.
Okay.
Now, the negative letters are the ones that you have no idea why the person's writing to you. You don't know if they even wrote a book, okay? They're just going all over the place, and the purpose for their writing to you is buried somewhere in that letter.
Yeah.
And you don't have the energy to deal with that, even though it might be a good project. the other letter that I often get is, not often, but a percentage of the time, is the angry letter, the resentful letter.
Wow.
Where the person clearly feels that it's somehow it's unfair, or that they are being required to go through this humiliating process.
Yeah.
That it should really be self-evident that I am I'm amazing and I'm great, and I shouldn't have to write letters to strangers saying that, you know. And I only bring that up because it happened.
Do those letters go along with any certain kinds of books? Like, do you see that more in, like, the business books or the, I mean?
No, I'll tell you where I see them mostly, memoirs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Autobiographies. The other big mistake is, and I see this all the time, the very first paragraph is the author is telling you how many times they've already been rejected.
Oh, no.
And for how long they've been trying to get published.
Oh, no.
Now, I don't know why they're apologizing for even trying to get you to pay attention to them. I don't know why people do that. I know that these are very, very bright and intelligent people, but there's some kind of a mindset they have which is really undermining their own abilities,
mm-hmm.
you know, their own prospects.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of like you wouldn't buy a car if the ads said, you know, we break down most of the time. And we have. You know, we have broken down most of the time. But people will write pitch letters like that.
Yeah. Well, I assume it's sort of a person that's comfortable with self-deprecation as a way of sort of like bonding with somebody, but it doesn't work in this.
Not in the business world.
Yeah.
Might work with, you know, Ann Landers or whatever.
Right. Now, you mentioned a little bit ago about making sure you query the genre that this person is looking for, that the agent actually is looking for. But I have a question about that. How often do agents change genres? For example, deciding to take on, let's say, fantasy, you know, now it's gaining in popularity. And what's involved in changing genres? Like, if an agent has been really steadfastly selling nonfiction for a long time, is it hard to break into selling another genre?
I don't think that individual agents really change that much as to what they want to see. They may expand upon what they're reading,
okay.
what they're interested in.
Okay.
And or they may retain another agent to work with them who has that. So the agency might expand, but not the individual agent. And the reason I say that is, just like everyone else, agents tend to have certain aptitudes.
Mm-hmm.
They really have, or passions. So they may have a really strong commercial aptitude about a certain kind of fiction and a real passion with reading it. It's not a struggle for them to read it. It's not like painful for them to read it.
Right.
And that will usually shape what they do and don't want to agent. And it may be that they've had a hidden passion that they just didn't put out there, or a hidden aptitude that they didn't put out there that they later decide to. That's possible.
Right.
But if the aptitude and the passion isn't there at one point, at the beginning point, I don't know that they really change that much.
But if they do, let's say that they do change, from the business standpoint, is it hard to break into a new network of editors, for example, if you've only been working with a certain genre and you decide to do something else?
I would say no.
No.
Not for an agent.
Okay.
Because the agent knows what needs to be done, and the agent can find out who the acquisition editors are and can introduce themselves. And the editors, most editors, are willing to have relationships with agents who are going to show them quality, eligible product.
Yeah.
They don't want to have relationships with agents who are going to do the opposite of that.
Okay. All right. This is, you also, in the book, you include a number of essays that are guest written by other people in your industry. One is an essay by Deborah Herman, who I believe is your wife. And I loved her essay. One of the reasons she writes about spiritual writers, which she describes as people who write because they have to and they love to, which I think actually all writers sort of start out that way, or many, many do. But I loved that she addresses ego in this essay. She writes, "When we connect with our inner truth, we can become intoxicated with our own greatness. Writing is a very heady thing, especially if we are able to see our name in print. If we have people listening to what we have to say, we can believe that we are the message and forget that we are merely the messenger. Spiritual writers need to start every day by praying for humility." And I loved that. I think that's such an important lesson. I think we always have to remember that what we're writing for is the work. You know, the work is what really matters and not the author. Or I think that's a healthier way to make your way. And I think it's probably a key to success. But do you want to talk about that at all?
She's much better at talking about that aspect
okay.
of it, than I am. But I understand what she's saying. And What does happen sometimes is a person, a writer who has had success in the spiritual or self-help realm, doesn't have to be directly spiritual, will sometimes feel that they are equal to or even more important than the message, and that they are somehow more important than the people who are reading it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how else to explain it, but it warps the value of it. And you can actually become, because human beings do like to be led, you can actually become sort of an egomaniac narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still have some good information.
Right.
And you can still have hordes of people who are waiting for your next word. But it's still somehow warps the true value of what's being delivered. It's serving other purposes
right.
after a while.
And I would say, apart from the type of writing, you know, no matter what the genre, I think sometimes we can get lost in our vision of the kind of author we're going to be and the kind of accolades we're going to get and the prizes we're going to win. And so that's sort of what her message spoke to me. And I think it applies to the business of getting published, too, you know, not letting your ego carry you away and becoming one of those clients from hell. So,
yeah, I think the healthiest way to do it is to let yourself ride on the coattails of the quality of your material, whatever it is you're writing.
Right.
But let that be, you know, let that carry you forward. And then you're, you know, you're still subservient in a way to your product
mm-hmm.
in that way, instead of making the product subservient to you.
Okay. This is a matter of maybe sort of like the minutia of the rules of the thing, but I'm curious, for fiction, how long should a synopsis be if the agent doesn't specify in guidelines how long a synopsis should be? I've had long conversations with people about this. Is it 3 pages? Is it 20? You know?
Yeah, I know. I don't even like that word.
Synopsis?
Synopsis. It's so weird. And I'm assuming it's some kind of Greek-Latin thing. You know, that just kind of got stuck in there. And, you know, it's a term that existed when I started, you know, in the 80s.
Right.
And I'm sure it pre-exists me, you know. But basically, think of it as a story summary.
Yeah.
And it's got to really be well-written as your actual story.
Right.
Your storytelling. Except it's extremely abbreviated. You know, if you have a 100,000 word novel, you should think of your synopsis as being 1-2% of that.
Okay.
That's
good. Let's do math. That's good.
yeah. 1-2% of your, of the actual, you know, word count. And make it so that, you know, a model to use is you go to a movie theater, before the feature comes on, there's going to be 3 to 5 coming attractions.
Right.
And no matter how bad those movies might actually be, the coming attractions are fun to watch. Even if you know, gee, I'm not going to see that movie, it's still fun to watch the coming attractions. And you'll definitely get a sense of what the film is so that you can decide whether or not you even want to see it.
Right.
You know? And that's what a synopsis is supposed to do. It's supposed to engage, and then it's supposed to let the editor or the agent know, gee, is this something that I really want to go further with.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Once somebody signs with an agent, how much should they let the agent do their own thing and just kind of wait to see what happens? And how much should they kind of be involved, maybe suggesting presses and editors that they feel would be good for their work and, you know, that sort of thing?
Okay. Again, that really comes down to, you know, first you have to get the agent. Right. You have to get the relationship solid.
Right.
And then you really should have communication. Ask the agent. You know, again, ask the agent, you know, what is your projected time frame? And how can I help you? You know,
right.
if that, you know, I'm available, you let me know if you need more information. If, you know, what you could do is if something happens in your life or your career that's relevant to the book, you should immediately bring that to the attention
yep.
of the agent so yep. that the agent can use that. What I don't think agents really want is the client necessarily telling them what publishers or editors to submit it to.
Yeah.
You know, because they kind of see that as their, you know, I mean, you can offer to give that info. If you have a connection, if you have a friend who knows a certain editor,
right.
for instance, you can offer that.
Yeah. All right, great. Now, you also wrote a great book, which I believe you also regularly update, about writing the nonfiction book proposal. And I wonder, just sort of generally, do you have any advice about writing a nonfiction book proposal, having seen, I'm sure, many good and bad examples of them?
Well, the crucial part with the nonfiction book proposal is that you don't want to have to write the manuscript in order to get the deal.
Right.
And that's the big difference between fiction and nonfiction. It's fiction, you really have to write the manuscript.
Yeah, yeah.
Nonfiction, really all you need is a book proposal.
Right.
And the most crucial aspect of that is really having a clear vision in your own head of what your book is going to be, even though you haven't written it yet.
Right.
And that's what needs to be conveyed in the book proposal.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a very clear overview statement, which is just a couple of hundred words. You need to have a really well-organized and well-expressed outline, which it's probably going to be a few couple of thousand words
right.
at the most, the yeah. outline, but it very much explains the book from A to Z. And then, of course, in nonfiction, the author is part of the product in most cases. So you need to show how you are relevant to the subject, what brings you to the subject, and how you are standing in that particular industry or in those communities, especially social media, can all be leveraged to help create word of mouth. Because the oldest technology in book publishing is word of mouth,
right.
which goes back hundreds of years. So it's really a question of how do you deliver the word of mouth. So today it's not done with direct mail. Today it's done with direct email or just being in a community where you engage and create other people. It's called going viral.
Yeah.
So publishers are looking for people who can create those viral connections.
Yeah. Great. So let's see, as we wind down, I always sort of end asking for advice for writers. And in your case, I was thinking, you know, having read this book, you also have a section that talks about the publishers, whether they're indies or part of conglomerates. There are basically big five conglomerates. And then you do address a little bit about self-publishing and a little bit about hybrid publishing. I just wonder if you had to have advice about how people can figure out where they fit. And I know that's kind of a big question, but do you have any ideas that you might like put out there for people that are a little confused about all of this?
Well, most people can go either big house or small house, and there's really no qualitative difference. The difference between, well, there is a crucial difference. The big houses, especially when it comes to nonfiction, do not do anymore what's called the mid-list.
Right.
These were the books that only had to sell maybe 10 to 20,000 copies a year.
Yeah.
If even that, to be acquired and to be valued, because they were creating in combination with 100 other mid-list books per season, they were creating positive revenue. And the writers could be evolved to a higher level. So now that it's become conglomerated and Fortune 100 media companies now own all these publishing assets, they don't really have patience for that. They don't have a model for that.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the mid-listing has, by default, gone to the independents because their capitalization, to a great extent, only enables them to do those kinds of books because they can't lay out six-figure and seven-figure advances.
Right.
Now, with self-publishing, studies have shown that something like 95% of the self-published books only sell 5 copies a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
something
what's
like
that about? Is that because people are publishing books for their family? I mean, what is that about?
Well, that's who the 5 people might be who actually paid money for it, friends and family. But you see, anybody, especially, you know, you can go to open sources like, you know, Smashwords or even CreateSpace, and for nominal money, you know, upload your novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no, the rejection rate is zero.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Because you're the only person who could say, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, so of course, what's happening is millions of people have. I mean, there's got to be 10 million self-published books on CreateSpace.
Right.
Or something like that. So, putting it there in and of itself means nothing. However, if you then are able to create a social community or communities for yourself, where you are able to entice people to then go to Amazon or other sites, other open source sites, to actually purchase your book, that happens. And there are a small percentage of self-publishers in all categories who are selling a lot of books because they are engaged in fan sites and other places. There are certain categories that are much easier to do this in. Romance and women's fiction, especially women's mystery, is much more conducive to fan communities. And there's just so much real estate out there for the people who write this and publish in this to talk to each other.
Yes.
And they buy each other's books, and they like each other's books, and they give good reviews to each other's books. So that seems to work, you know, and that's the only way it can work.
Because they're finding the niches in which they can, you know, sort of describe themselves and be recognized as something that the niche enjoys and sell.
Yeah, they're getting people to buy their book. Now, they won't get bookstore distribution unless it goes to such a level, like with 50 Shades of Grey 15 years ago, or 10 years ago, if it goes to such a level that people are actually calling the bookstores, their physical bookstores, saying, do you have this book?
Right.
That's, that, you know, and that happens, you know, less than 1% of the time, obviously.
Right.
That's when you could get into bookstore distribution. Even if you still don't have a traditional publisher, you can still get a distributor.
Yeah. Okay.
But the bookstores won't order the book unless readers are ordering the book through them.
Right. Now, what about hybrid publishers? I know that those are a little different. They still have sort of like a submission process, and there is a rejection rate, or at least some advice for people to pursue other avenues before they come back with their manuscript.
Okay.
What is that like?
In my opinion, the rejection rate is based upon how much money you can put on the table as a writer.
Okay.
If you go to a hybrid house and you don't have any money, I think you'll be rejected, no matter, before they even read the manuscript. If you go to a hybrid house and you have $20,000, and they'll actually have a freelance editor on staff or whatever to read the manuscript, if they think it's not good, they'll say, well, we can edit this for you and make it good, you know, but you'll have to pay us this.
Right.
And that might be a perfectly legitimate, valid transaction.
Mm-hmm.
But the hybrid publisher, their services have to be paid for, everything they do. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily equal genuine bookstore distribution, unless somehow the bookstores feel that there's a reason why they need your book in the store.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you have to get people asking the bookstore for the book.
Yeah.
But you can still do well on other sales platforms or your own website if you, again, create the social community. And the hybrid publisher may have those services. They may be able to help you learn how to use social media, blogging, whatever, you know, to create a community. But you have to pay for that.
Yep. All right, great. That was a wonderful summary of something I thought was going to be a bigger question than you might want to answer. All right, I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents, and it's published by New World Library. Jeff Herman, thank you very much for speaking with me. I really found it very elucidating, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.
This is the podcast of Write the Book, which airs on 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington every Monday at 4. Write the Book is a show for writers and curious readers, and you've just heard an interview with author and agent Jeff Herman about the 28th edition of his book, Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents from New World Library. You can learn more at jeffherman.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Jeff Herman. Write a query letter. Jeff says the letter really is a sales pitch. Keep that in mind as you work. Tell the agent that you're addressing about why you are reaching out, especially if you're a fan of work that they have sold. Let them know why you respect that work and hope yours will appeal to them. The letter should be short, 1.5 pages or fewer, readable, direct, and personalized. Jeff writes on his website, say what you have, why it's hot, why you're a good prospect, and what's available for review upon request. You can find a lot of information on Jeff's website about how to write a query letter, and there is a format that you should follow. Even if your work isn't quite ready to send the query letter, practicing writing one is a good idea, because it takes a while to get it just right. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. We broadcast every Monday at 4 from 99.3 FM WBTV LP in Burlington, Vermont. The show streams online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.